Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that believes in a property-owning democracy. My name's Corey Hazelhurst. I'm our partner in propaganda with Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
And we're joined once again by Friends of the Earth activist Shaz Marmon. Hello, Shaz.
Hello, again. Again.
On today's podcast, we're talking about cooperatives.
Yeah, sure. So at its basic principle, a cooperative is a way of structuring an organisation where ownership is had by the stakeholders. So there are many different forms of cooperatives, but I'll give a couple of examples of ones that I'm involved in because that'll be an easy way to demonstrate that. So for example, Birmingham Friends of the Earth is a community benefit society. So what that means is it's a cooperative designed for social good. It's a member-based organisation where we do have a board. We have a board of directors who are elected. So every 3 years, I would stand, and then if the members of the organisation thought I wasn't very good, they could then replace me with somebody else who was elected. Membership of the organisation is £1, and with that, you get voting rights, you get a say in the organisation. If you have a say in the organisation, you are more emotionally committed to the organisation and you want it to succeed. Another organisation that I'm a member and a director of is Community Energy Birmingham. Difference to Birmingham Friends of the Earth. Birmingham Friends of the Earth is a campaigning organisation that owns a building, but its sole aim really is to try and make Birmingham a more sustainable city, to try and change the world to be a more environmentally friendly place. Community Energy Birmingham puts solar panels or renewable technology on buildings. It's a bit more of a hardware-based cooperative where, again, there's a board of directors. They get voted in after a period of time. This is slightly different because we've raised quite a bit of money, and what we do with that money is we've used that to put solar panels on buildings, and then we pay an interest rate on that. We've had two share offers from members. Member will invest £250, £10,000, somewhere in that region, in the middle of somewhere usually, and then what we do is we pay 4% rate of return every year, and the rate of return is based on what we think is fair to the investor and limited, so we don't end up bankrupting the organisation. And the final one I'll mention is Central England Cooperative, which is a retail co-op, so it's a completely different structure. It's also massively different in scale. It's £1 billion.
So is that the, if you see a cooperative supermarket, it's that basically?
It's one of them. It's okay. Very, very complicated. So obscure Birmingham reference, we're in the Sturchley area of Birmingham. There are four or five Central England Cooperatives in the local vicinity. But if you were in Scotland, it could be a mid-Scots cooperative. Or if you live where I live, slightly out southwest Birmingham, there is a co-op group. So co-op group are all over the nation, all over the country. And then you've got regional Central England co-ops. But it gets so complicated. So if it's got like the blue and grey labelling on the storefront, it's going to be a co-op group. If it's like the green one, the more traditional one, it could be any number of co-ops.
And I hadn't even noticed the blue and grey one.
Yeah, well, the one in the city centre by Snowhill Station, that's the newer branding.
Okay. Yeah. We'll have to do a Not Enough Champagne trip and see the two different types.
Well, it used to be a Waitrose, now it's a co-op.
Yeah, I noticed. Yeah.
I say, that's outside my office. I go there every couple of days or so.
Waitrose closing in Birmingham. It's like, reverse gentrification? So in terms of those three different co-ops, so in terms of the Birmingham Friends of the Earth one, it's more
Do you want me to finish the
Sure.
Yeah, so Central England Co-op is a retail co-op. So basically what we do is we sell food. Also, it's got a funeral business, there's a travel business, and florists and a few other things. Is anybody can be a member, and what happens then is the members get a share of the profits. They also get to vote in directors who then appoint the executive as just normal employees and the business owners as normal employees. Members get to vote on things like what the actual payments is to shareholders, what we do with the money that goes towards good causes. So things like it has a corporate social responsibility arm which funds local community activities. Members get a say in that. Central England co-op and other co-ops, they say, hopefully are more ethical in nature as well. So you tend to find lower pay ratio gaps, those kind of things, because the membership doesn't want to see, sorry, the chief exec earning 400,000 times more than, you know, the average employee. Obviously, that's an exaggeration, but you get the point. And so these are three different co-ops, but they have very similar themes running through them as to why they're successful.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it's not even like you can say, on one hand, you've got Birmingham Friends of the Earth cooperative organisation, aim isn't to make a profit, it's just to do good, I'm going to put in quote marks, because obviously that's quite an important thing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, as you say, the Central England Co-op, multi-million pound business, its job is to make a profit, but not just that, because you've also got then the social responsibility on top and the social aims that it wants to enact as well. So even when you've got two very different co-ops, two massively different turnovers, one sounds like a more big business, there's still quite similarities in the way that they approach in their philosophy.
So to add to that, so Birmingham Friends of the Earth does run as a business. It still has to at least cover its own costs, but its aim isn't to, if it breaks even, that's okay, per se. Where, Central England Co-op is a business like any other business, in the sense that we make a profit, we register that profit to shareholders, but it's cooperatively owned, so everyone has a bigger stake. Just add another type of co-op. There's a thing called a worker co-op as well, where another obscure Birmingham reference. There are several in Sturchley, close to where we are now. There's Birmingham Bike Foundry, where they repair and sell second-hand bikes. Every worker there will own a stake in the business, so all the profits would be divided between them. The same with Loaf, which is a bakery on Sturchley High Street. That's a worker co-op, so everyone who works there owns it. Any profits are shared out between them, and then any losses are also shared out between them. So there's a higher risk as well as being a higher reward.
So when people talk about the John Lewis model, is that the model that they mean?
John Lewis is one of the highest profile cooperatives.
Okay. Certainly in terms of labour policy and labour circles, there's been a bit of a shift, hasn't there, to trying to promote cooperatives as a way of business. So there was, I think a couple of years ago, there was an alternative models of ownership report, and we, before the episode, we looked at a New Economics Foundation report on cooperatives, which I think was commissioned by the Cooperative Party.
It is.
Which we'll put in the show notes. It's a really interesting look at not just co-ops in the UK and the differences in the co-op system with the UK and other countries, but also it's trying to look at ways of encouraging co-ops in the UK and how you can do that. So why should the government be trying to encourage more co-ops?
Because it's a different way of working. If you're part of a co-op, you're more emotionally attached to that co-op, and generally speaking, the profits, the surpluses, the social benefits are shared more equally between the members. If you just have a typical PLC, what happens is, if you're a big business, big multinational, where does the money go? It generally doesn't stay in the local community. It generally may end up in Luxembourg, may end up in the Cayman Islands. With cooperatives, that community benefit stays within the community. So the members of Central Income Co-op are employees. They'll get a dividend, a member dividend, as well as being an employee. So, and then that means they'll like to spend that in the local area, because they're not going to be earning enough to go and filter it through the Cayman Islands.
Well, yeah, so there was a really interesting stat I liked in the report, which was that in 2011 there was a study in John Lewis' staff and where they spent their bonus, and they spent 20 to 25% of their bonus altogether in the same local area in which they were employed. So it's proper income going around that local area.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of really one of the major kind of like benefits actually of like the co-op model, is that the money just very much stays within the area or the region where the workers are actually based. So you are just putting that money back into the local economic ecosystem, which obviously then has more of an impact, you know, locally than it would do if it just ends up in the Cayman's bank account or whatever.
And that's also true in terms of money that stays in the national tax system as well. So the other stat, which is a little bit mind-boggling, is that the five largest cooperatives in the UK paid 50% more corporation tax than Amazon, Facebook, Apple, eBay and Starbucks altogether.
Yeah.
So, because I suppose it's harder for them to avoid tax. which is nice.
And yeah. also, they may not have the same desire to chase that ability.
That quick buck.
Yeah. So the two biggest ones are the Kirk Group and John Lewis Biomassive Distillers, and they're both retail co-ops.
I think what's really interesting, just in terms of thinking about a kind of left-wing socialist approach to business and enterprise, it's the idea of people working together for an outcome for a social good, as opposed to, and this is something that always struck me reading The Future of Socialism, is that one of the things he says that socialism is about cooperation and not competition. And I think that, especially that, the idea of neoliberalism and free market capitalism is the idea of different firms competing. But this is a way of trying to make firms which of people who work together for a distinct end, which I think is a really positive way of going about this business, in the way that rather than talking like a kind of top-down nationalistic approach, nationalisation approach.
Yeah, and I think that's really one of the kind of like the really interesting things about the co-op model, is that whilst it is absolutely a left-wing ideal, it's, you know, empowering workers, all of that sort of stuff, it's the sort of thing which really the right shouldn't be able to make a strong argument against in any meaningful way, because you're not saying, hey, let's overthrow the capitalist system. You're just saying, let's give the workers a say in the business, and then within that situation you could still have a functioning market of, you know, let's use retail co-ops as an example of Waitrose versus your co-op on the high street competing with each other as they would do if it was Sainsbury's and Tesco at the same time. So it's not necessarily anathema to them in the same way as other areas would be.
And also, to add another point, co-ops are more resilient than other kinds of businesses. Like the report says, like 90% of co-ops survive the first 3 years, which is much higher than your alternative. And so because everybody involved has a stake, and therefore, if it goes wrong, it's on them.
And I suppose also you've got people you can fall back onto if you're part of a board on, say, Birmingham Friends of the Earth. If, for instance, if you're ill for a bit as a sole trader, say, that has massive implications for your business. If you're part of a co-op and a board, there are people who can pick up the slack a little bit if one of you isn't fit.
And you can find new directors as well if you need to be. You can co-op somebody in if you feel they have the values. And
see, then, we did that.
Yes, and then they'll be voted in an election.
I think it's really interesting. The mentions lots of studies from places like America, France, Spain, Italy, where co-ops have been seen to be more productive as well. And we always talk in Britain about the fact that we have a productivity problem. Again, part of that is a lack of investment, which probably comes about because we talked about this in terms of tax evasion before, didn't we? If you've got companies like Facebook, Apple, they're more likely to try and chase the books rather than want to pay their taxes. But it also means they're trying to chase short-term profits in a way that co-ops aren't. And so co-ops are more likely to invest. But also, if you have a stake in your business and you're happier working there, well, there's not only less staff turnover in co-ops, but also you tend to be more productive because I suppose everyone's pulling in the same direction. There's a kind of shared ethos there.
Yeah, you're less likely to be ill because you feel you're part of something. You're more likely to want to go to work rather than you feel like you're being exploited if you're an Amazon warehouse where, you know, one small strike, two small strikes, three, you're gone. Whereas in those kind of environments, you're being tested and tested again to succeed under enormous pressure. The co-op structure means that those situations should not happen. And if they do, it's a failure of the organisation. And on the flip side, if you're a customer and you're buying from cooperatives, so for example, I went to my local central income and bought a bottle of wine. I bought it because it was fair trade. So I know there were certain minimum standards involved. I know that the workers involved may not necessarily be paid as much as they should be, but will be paid at least a minimum price, which is better than the market rate in that whatever country it is. And I know that there'll be a premium. So a certain percentage of the revenue will go into a pot that will help the local community, or at least help the producers of the wine. And so you have that guarantee there that what you're buying has an ethical value as well. It's not just, I go to Amazon Prime because it's really cheaper, it delivers me a fantastic service. It's a two-way communication. It's a, I'm doing this because I want there to be something that has value rather than I just want the best products at the cheapest price.
It's interesting the report kind of mentions some of the barriers to co-ops, one of the big barriers being finance and trying to get financial backing for the project, which I'm guessing is partly because linked with most co-ops, I think, are quite small businesses, aren't they? I think the report's saying that over the 6,000 or something, I think 41 of them are medium or large businesses. So trying to find financial backing in the first place can be a really, really big problem.
Definitely. And so, as we were talking about before, if you're a small business, it's hard enough to get capital in the first place if you're a traditional structure. If you're a co-op, there is no real legislation out there that is designed to help you. It's not taught in schools at all. You can even go to university with a business degree and cooperative studies isn't there. If you want to go get a loan to start up, most banks will go, well, this structure is complicated. And therefore, whilst you still can get finance, it'll be easy if you were a CIC, it'll be easy if you're just a PLC. And so lots of people who may have cooperative ideas will be put off because those barriers at the start are very significant.
Do you think maybe start an MBA in cooperative studies or cooperative management? I can see that working.
Oh, there is a cooperative college. You could do a PhD in cooperative studies if you wanted to.
Ooh.
Everything's based up in Manchester, Rochdale for these kind of things.
Oh, I suppose, yeah.
Makes sense.
Well, yeah, pioneer of the Rochdale co-op movement. Or maybe it's just Andy Burnham. He embodies the North.
Oh, yeah, just to go back slightly. So when we talk about neoliberalism, post-war, there was a massive boom in cooperatives. So there used to be, if you had your high street, for example, in Great Bar, another obscure Birmingham reference in the north of the city.
We don't get many North Birmingham references, so extra kudos.
Yeah, so it would be quite commonplace to have a... So we still have one sort of in Great Bar. So you've got a cooperative supermarket. Next door, you've got a cooperative funeral home. And then back in the day, well, we've got a florist there as well. But back in the day, you'd have a cooperative shoemaker as well. And a cooperative butcher. And so the 50s and 60s, these small enterprises were absolutely flourishing. And then as time went on, some of the bigger ones merged or they went out of business. And then we came to the 80s and Thatcher. And the industry, cooperatives didn't end, but they took a right kicking.
Mm.
The ethos went away from having cooperative structures that were working together to boom and bust, you know. If you're a winner, fantastic. If you're a loser, you don't matter anymore.
And I suppose if anyone thinks about the government trying to promote cooperatives in Britain at all, it tends to be, I think, Tony Benn as industry secretary in the 70s, I think, tries to promote cooperatives. But as I understand it, basically what Tony Benn was trying to do was take businesses that were failing anyway and he just turned them into cooperatives and then put a load of money into these businesses which then didn't work, which isn't really how co-ops work.
Yes. And also, there are other forms of cooperatives that you don't necessarily associate. So, for example, Nationwide is a mutual. That's a form of cooperatives. It's a form of cooperative. I vote every year on the directors. A credit union, another form of cooperative where... it's much more ethical to get a loan from them because they're not going to charge an extortionate interest rate like Wonga would have done back in the day.
Mm.
And if you do have trouble because you're part owner, they'll be treating you more fairly. Unions, another example of a traditional co-op model where everyone pays in their subs and they get benefits like if you're ill at work, you may be able to get some money for that to cover the time you're off. Or if you're in a disciplinary hearing, you can get representation to make sure you're treated fairly. The cooperative model goes into many different industries and looks at many different things.
Yeah, and I think that's quite an interesting little notion that effectively pretty much everybody is probably involved with something that is a co-op in some form of their everyday life. Even if it is just a case of, oh, occasionally you will go into the co-op retail store to pick up whatever it is. But if you are a member of a union, if you are a member of some form of organisation that operates in that same kind of membership-led way where you get voting rights and things like that, then, you know, I think maybe one of the challenges around in this is just making people realise how prevalent that model actually is. Because if you can get people thinking about those things actually as part of the co-op model, then maybe you can burst through some of the barriers that people have mentally about these sorts of things, rather than just thinking of co-op as the brand. Yes. Then it becomes co-op is the business model.
Because it also gets quite complicated. So, for example, Co-op Bank isn't a cooperative, it's PLC. So it has no cooperative structure in it whatsoever anymore. It did back in the day. It was partnered by Co-op Group. But you know when they almost went bust, Co-op Bank?
That was what they had to get rid of, wasn't it?
There was a rather high-profile problem with their chief exec, wasn't there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Was that the guy who was doing all the cocaine?
Allegedly.
allegedly.
Again, the report mentions a few challenges for cooperatives, which, I mean, these, again, I've just got them listed in my notes here of automation and inequality, surveillance, capitalism, and ecological overshoot, which are all a little bit big to talk about as part of a bigger episode. But one of the challenges it does talk about is the idea of trying to bring public services back in-house. And this is, again, this is where we talked about Labour trying to talk about alternative models of ownership. And given the failure of Carillion and the outsourcing of public services, rather than taking every single public service in-house, one thing that you could do is turn these public, it is essentially outsourced to or mutualise, I suppose, the company and give it back. I mean, we talked about Thomas Cook in the midweek shop and about maybe the government isn't quite going to bail out Thomas Cook and nationalise Thomas Cook. But equally, if you had, say, a national investment bank and you could lend money to Thomas Cook and mutualise it, that could be an alternative way of trying to save the company. Or you could even do that with, say, there is the West Coast Main Line. Back in the day, that was put under public ownership. It could have been mutualised.
So just to go back to the Thomas Cook point, it's now been saved by another company called Hayes, but Central England Co-op runs travel agents as well, and they saw a massive increase. We had our interim members meeting on Thursday, doubled business upon last year. One of the reasons for that is, if you're going with a travel provider, who do you trust? The Co-op is a trusted brand. They're not going to go out of business next week. If I book a holiday with them, Central England Co-op will mean that my holiday happens. Whereas, who knows what happens with lots of these PLCs. I didn't know that Thomas Cook was about to go under, and then there was no Thomas Cook anymore.
No, and then it just
happened.
And if these things are like going to happen in a cooperative, hopefully, because the structures are more equal, you're going to know it's going to happen, so you're not left in the lurch overnight. Like, these Thomas Cook employees went to work and suddenly the shops are shut and that's the first they heard of it.
And I suppose, yeah, because co-ops have that kind of democratic accountability structure in place.
Yeah, yes. You can't just make a decision to try and, you know, sell the business or anything like that very quickly.
You can't say, you can't give yourself millions in shares and then run away.
Not very easily, I suppose. But in terms of this kind of oversight structure, so you've mentioned you're on the board of a couple of the cooperatives. Is there a lot of engagement in that process? Are there hustings as such?
So Bogan Frenzy FM, Community Energy, Bogan are similar in the way they run. So what will happen is, if somebody wants to stand for the board, there'll be an election and you submit your application in advance. So, and then you'd have an election between an existing person and a new person. Though in a lot of cases, a lot of community groups will find the same thing, is that we're not oversubscribed with people. So if we know somebody who we think suitable, they will usually get elected.
Okay.
Though Central England Co-op is different because it's a £1 billion organisation. It's highly sought after. Community Energy Birmingham and Bogan Frenzy Earth are both voluntary sector organisations who at most have a couple of paid staff, but all of the directors are volunteers doing something because they believe in social good.
If we talk about what the report talks about in terms of policy to promote co-ops, one of the things is, as you said, is there isn't a lot of realisation amongst people of the fact that co-ops are a thing that you can do and a useful thing you can do. So a lot of the recommendations the report has tend to be things like putting in a legal framework in place so people are able to get a co-op, a national investment bank that will lend to co-ops, or even things like, if I think someone's unemployed, then one of the things is maybe lending a loan to try and set up a cooperative business. Nuts and bolts stuff like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, and those things exist for other organisations and structures, so they should exist for the cooperative movement as well. So even just having an organisation that was there to regulate specific cooperatives would make life so much easier. Because if you want to start one now, you're filled with so much bureaucracy. You're audited by the Financial Conduct Authority, which, you know, is there to look after banks' regulation rather than cooperative regulation. They've just been pushed into a corner because it was probably convenient at the time. There wasn't really any thinking about that. If you're a small cooperative, why is the Financial Conduct Authority relevant to you? Like, you're not Barclays, or you're not probably not even a financial institution.
Well, no, so it's very much a kind of square peg in round hole type regulation. Yes. Where, well, co-ops are a business, this regulates business, fine.
Yeah, and especially if you're really a small co-op as well, with three or four members, that is such a minefield to get through, that, which is why so many people give up and just choose something else.
Yeah, just that kind of red tape generally.
Yeah, compare and contrast that to the ease at which you can set yourself up as a sole trader, or as an LTD, a limited company. It's night and day. So you can literally spend maybe half an hour to an hour and set yourself up as an LTD, just going through the gov.uk website and paying like £30 or something like that. It's a really simple thing to actually run through. And so, yeah, if you've got a choice between just doing that and something you can do in an evening versus having to deal with all of the different bureaucracy and potential different models as well of what type of co-op you want to be, you know, you can see exactly why people might be put off from that.
Yeah, and to add to that as well, it's really easy to set up as a COIC, a community interest company, which is there to do community good, but it's because it's under Companies House, it's so much easier to set up. There were lots of organisations there that could have been a cooperative but became a COIC just because it's really easy to do. They had a great idea, they wanted to get started, and they thought, oh, this is the easiest way to get started, and they just run, and then a couple of years down the line, they realise this isn't necessarily the most ethical way of doing it, this isn't necessarily the best structure, but it's really hard to switch to a cooperative once you're not a cooperative. So COICs have to reinvest their surplus or profit into the organisation, but aside from that, there isn't really much in terms of barriers or things they can't do, so you can still do goods, but you could also fund that money off somewhere else in high salaries, so, and therefore your surplus isn't much to reinvest. But it's not saying CIC is a bad thing, but it isn't necessarily always the right decision, and the cooperatives need to have more of a chance to compete as an option.
Offhand, do you know of any examples of CICs? Like, are there any names that we'd know?
I'm also involved in an organisation called the Real Drink Free Project Birmingham, and what that does, it intercepts waste food that will go into landfill or a bin and serves it in community cafes and events. That basically was just an example of what I've said there. The two people, Gareth and Eileen, were amazing people who had an amazing idea, set it up as quickly as they could, and then that's what the organisation is.
Because one of the other recommendations the report has is trying to accelerate existing businesses who want to become cooperatives to become cooperatives as well, which sounds like it's quite difficult at the moment.
Well, so, for example, with a CIC, there's no real accountability. The directors can go do whatever they want. So, for example, if you're a cooperative, you have to have an AGM. You have to be accountable to your members. With a CIC, there's no obligation to do any of that. Issues can happen there, whereas with a cooperative structure, you have to report back every year. You have to file. You have to make sure that your members are aware of what you're doing and keeps that relationship between you and everyone else in the organisation on a more level playing field.
The final recommendation in the report is something we've talked about as well in the podcast, which is localism and the Preston model. So again, we've talked about this before. It's one of the benefits of cooperatives is being able to keep that spending in the local area, in a local community. And so being able to essentially, I suppose, give local authorities more power over businesses that they have and over the businesses in the local community is also a really, really important thing as well.
Yeah, and the Preston model is doubly important because as a council facing masses of cuts, they didn't really know a way out, and a very innovative way of making sure that sourcing of labour and contracts was kept locally was through the co-op model. It meant that you didn't have massive carillion coming in and then going bust. The economy stays stronger because the money is staying within the area.
Because Preston, what they do as a council is try and outsource to other local companies, don't they?
Yes.
Yeah. And then people who work for those companies spend their money in Preston and that money stays in the local economy. And it's done, I think, pretty well, hasn't it, in terms of growth rates and competence as well. It's a proper like Labour Council success story.
Yes, in amongst many other cities who haven't tried to do this, who have had their funding slashed and just slashed services.
Mm.
So I'd say that Preston has done everything brilliantly, but it has fared much better than other cities that have had to face these cuts.
Is the future bright, do you reckon, for the co-op movement? Do you think there's a good chance that a future Labour government would try and push in this direction?
hope so. Partly because the Cooperative Party will be there to try and kick them along. But also, there's a growing realisation that neoliberalism isn't working for everybody. There's a tiny percentage that does very well. Though, in terms of, if you look at spirit level and income inequality, everyone loses overall.
We have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. And our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. And Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm on Twitter @paperbackwriter.
I'm @acousticradical.
@shazroman30.
Happy plotting.